The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last program, we were talking about jellyfish, cnidarians. I think I've said all that I wish to, with one exception. I would like to note the comment in the textbook concerning the origin of cnidaria. I find it very interesting. Again, this is Hickman et al. Hickman, Roberts, and Larson's Integrated Principles of Zoology. The origin of the cnidarians and the ctenophores, the comb fish, not comb fish, ctenophores, comb bearers, both of them found in this phylum. The origin of the cnidarians and the ctenophores is obscure, although the most widely supported hypothesis today is that the radiate phyla arose from a radially symmetrical planula-like ancestor. Such an ancestor would have been common to the radiates and to the higher metazoans, the latter having been derived from a branch whose members habitually crept about on the sea bottom. Such a habit would select for bilateral symmetry. Others became sessile or free-floating, conditions for which radial symmetry is a selective advantage. A planula larvae in which an invagination formed to become the gastrovascular cavity would correspond roughly to the cnidarian with an ectoderm and endoderm. Now, I hope you understand that what I have just read to you is absolute speculation. And there is no organism that resembles anything that was described in that paragraph that has ever been found. And yet we find in a well-accepted textbook a discussion which, because of its location, people who are not familiar with the subject would say, I guess these things really must have occurred back there somewhere. These fall into the category of the missing links, the things that are supposed to be the common ancestors but are routinely missing because of the terminology, because of the description. It is presented as though this is a realistic possibility. If it is, there simply has never been any organism that would have met the requirements that are here. And so you have the evolutionists tying themselves in some knots simply because of their insistence on the interrelationship of organisms, when in fact there not only has it not been established, it doesn't even make really good sense. Now, there follows some discussion that extends that particular paragraph, which I won't take time for. There's also an interesting comment in the section on adaptive radiation. I'm reading from the text. In their evolution, neither phylum has deviated far enough from its basic plan of structure. In the cnidaria, both the polyp and medusa are constructed on the same scheme. Likewise, the ctenophores, the comb jellies, have adhered to the arrangement of the comb plates and their radial symmetry. And it goes on talking about how successful they are. The point being that here are a group of organisms that are unbelievably successful. They have never changed from being that organism. They're not changing into something else. There is no evidence that they have changed from anything else to this. And yet, every chapter in this book that is discussing phyla, you'll have a similar discussion, speculating about what kinds of organisms might have been possible to be ancestors and whether or not there has been any development from these organisms towards something else. And the fact is, in both cases, those are just speculations, pure and simple. Now, the next in the sequence of phylum would be the platyhelminthes. Platy meaning flat, helminth is the Greek combining form for worm. So platyhelminthes are simply flat worms. In the parasitology text that I had when I was in graduate school, the author had a very interesting definition of a worm. Said a worm was anything that is long and round and not obviously something else, which leaves a rather broad description for organisms. This phylum, the flatworms, is interesting in my mind primarily because it is the first phylum that has three germ layers. Now, I've not discussed germ layers before. I'm not wild about doing it here, but there are three, if all are present, the ectoderm, endoderm, and mesoderm. These are layers that are formed in the embryo, and then they are going to give rise to the structures of the adult body. At some point, we're going to talk about embryology a little bit, and when we do that, we'll have occasion to discuss germ layers more. But the point here is that these germ layers then are also going to give rise to three body tissues, epithelium, endothelium, mesothelium. And the point is that this allows then for the formation of organs. In the first two phyla, Porifera and Cnidaria, there were no organs present in the organisms themselves. In some cases, there were collections of cells which might perform the functions of an organ, but they were not organs. But here in this phylum, we do finally have the actual organs themselves, collections of cells that are responsible for particular functions and do not do anything else other than those functions. It is an important phylum simply because, in my mind, because of the parasites that we find here. There is a free living, a phylum of free living organisms. This is, a class within the phylum, Turbellaria. These are organisms known as planaria, and we will talk about these a little bit later. There is another class which includes very, very important parasites of the human. I don't know any way to put a monetary value on the cost of these parasites to the human race, both by death, by illness, by removing people from being able to provide for their own welfare, etc. The trematodes are flukes of one kind or another, and we will talk a little bit about the types of flukes, about what they cause, etc. One of the things that I think you'll find interesting is the multiple hosts some of the organisms in the phylum have. There are lung flukes, blood flukes, liver flukes, etc. The third phylum within the phylum on the brain today, the third class within the phylum are the cestodes. The cestodes are the tapeworms. Now again, when we look at the organisms in these classes, they are very, very different from one another. If you simply looked at them and followed their life cycles, I really don't think you'd put them in the same category, other than the fact that they have the same shape. They are depressed. I will give you in a moment the biological definition of depressed. This means they are flattened dorsoventrally. If you can think of a cockroach, has a depressed body. It is flattened from back to belly. And all of the organisms in the phylum have depressed bodies. This is the first phylum that we will talk about systems. There is certainly a nervous system. There is an excretory system. There are reproductive systems. Again, we can stop here and comment briefly, at least, about the idea, what is it in evolution that would be the stimulus for organisms such as sponges or cnidarians, jellyfish, to add a germ layer, to create a new germ layer and create a new tissue, which in turn would allow for the formation of organs and systems within the body. Now, a long time ago, we talked about the interrelationship between DNA, RNA, and enzymes or proteins. And I commented then, and have made the comment since, that any structure which you see in an organism must have a prior basis in the genetic material. So that whenever we see a germ layer added, there has to be an addition to the DNA that was present in organisms that do not have that germ layer. And this is why I make the comment occasionally that evolution has to be creative. All through the steps of the process of evolution, there has to be continuing additions to the genetic material that are there. The environment certainly cannot be a basis for creating new genetic material. There is no way anyone can argue sensibly that the environment is going to affect the DNA in the nucleus of cells of an organism in order to add additional nucleotide sequences there that are of the proper base arrangement in order to produce given things, enzymes, or structures in an organism that were not there before it. One of the obvious characteristics of genetics is that parents will pass on to their offspring characteristics which they have. They do not pass on to their offspring characteristics they don't have. And this is simply a barrier to the idea that organisms such as the flatworms could have evolved from organisms that did not have the third germ layer, that did not have the structures that are found here. It beggars my mind when people talk apparently believingly about the possibility of this kind of thing happening, and more particularly when they are talking about the idea that the environment is going to be the basis for this, or some mental construct such as natural selection is going to be the basis of bringing about these internal changes in organisms which are going to add organs, body systems, enzymatic capabilities that were not present prior to that time. Now, this is wishful thinking in the extreme. I may sound like a broken record, but there is absolutely no evidence from science that these kinds of things are even possible, let alone that they have occurred. And yet, if the evolutionists are correct, whenever we go from one phylum to another, there are things of this sort which have not been present prior to that time and must be accounted for because of some additive, creative change that some unknown entity has brought about in the organism. Now, in my mind, it's much simpler to accept the fact that there was an intelligent creator who chose to create these organisms different from the others.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.